KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, it's been a bad week for Donald Trump. On Monday, he became the first president in history to face trial on criminal charges. His polls are down, and the stock price of Trump Media has fallen 60%. John Nichols will comment. Also, TV right now is featuring several prestige historical dramas. John Powers will compare two that shift the focus from the white man to Asian protagonists. The Sympathizer, centering on a spy for the communists in Vietnam and then in California in the 1970s, and Shogun, about feuding 17th century Japanese warlords. John Powers is critic at large for NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor at large of The American Prospect. We reached him today in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, let's start with the opposition to Biden's policy of unconditional military aid to the Netanyahu government in Israel's war against Palestinians in Gaza. The most visible opposition is coming from parts of the Democratic base, young people, people of color. But what about the mainstream of the party? Are they with Biden on this?
Increasingly, they're not. You see, basically, centrist Democrats opposing particular policies. So you have Senator Tim Kaine, a center-left Democrat from Virginia, who was, if anyone remembers, Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate in 2016, circulating a letter opposing the Biden administration's continuing incremental provision, even before a bill hits the floor of Congress, incremental provision of weapons to Israel. You have a letter signed by 40 House members saying we should hold Israel accountable if it's found to be violating stipulations on humanitarian aid, which it is, signed by none other than, among others, Nancy Pelosi, who certainly is the center of the Democratic Party, a very effective center, I might add. And Chris Van Hollen, another center-left senator from Maryland, has also been joining this chorus, which begins with Bernie Sanders and the squad. But I mean, come on, it's clearly, by the evidence of polls and by the evidence of what we're seeing in Congress, not really anymore the position of a majority of Democrats, both in the base and also to the highest level of elected officials.
So Biden seems to be losing the center of his party over this war. Is there any historical precedent for this?
Well, as you and I are a couple of, in your case, figurative and in my case, literal graybeards. Yeah, his name was Lyndon Johnson, who, like Biden, and even more so, had a pretty terrific record on domestic policy, but had a goddamn war, which, you know, began to alienate mainly members of his own party, less than the Republicans, as is the case today with Biden.
I believe that this opposition to LBJ came to a head at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in August 1968, and I believe you were there.
I was there. I was the fifth wheel on what remained of the research staff for Gene McCarthy's anti-war presidential campaign. And not only was there the infamous police riot against demonstrators in Grant Park, but there was also a concerted push for a peace plank, calling for stopping the bombing, the carpet bombing of Vietnam, and going immediately to negotiations that was presented on the floor of the Democratic Convention, which got about a third of the Democrats to vote for it. This encompassed a lot of mainstream Democrats, I mean, who were not visibly aligned with the anti-war movement.
Can you imagine a similar proposal being offered on the floor of the Democratic Convention this year in, I believe it's going to be in Chicago?
It's going to be in Chicago. The recidivist Democrats returning to the scene of the crime. Well, I can imagine it, but Democrats are so horrified at the prospect of weakening Biden because the alternative is Donald Trump, who is a lot worse than the Republican nominee in 1968, who was only, after all, Richard Nixon. There would be hesitation to do that. But, if nothing changes between now and the convention, it's certainly in the realm of the imaginary possible.
And does the imaginary possibilities, in your opinion, include demonstrations in the streets by thousands of young people confronting the Chicago police?
Absolutely. In the last couple of days, we've seen highways blocked in the Bay Area, in St. Louis, somewhere else, I think, in the Midwest. Yeah, I mean, unless the policy changes, I think that's all but guaranteed. And, it's in recent decades, cities have made sure that demonstrations were not authorized or allowed to happen near the convention hall. But in Chicago, that puts the demonstrations right back in Grant Park, which is where they were in 1968, for those of us nostalgic, either for the demonstrations or for police riots, which is what a government commission termed the conduct of Chicago's cops in response to those demonstrations.
I'm sure you remember the differences between 1968 and this year. In 1968, LBJ was forced out of his own re-election campaign by anti-war activists campaigning in the primaries, especially in New Hampshire, and then in coming up in Wisconsin, the candidacy of the candidate you were supporting, Gene McCarthy. Of course, there was a candidate, Dean Phillips, tried to do the same thing to Biden in New Hampshire that his Minnesota predecessor, Gene McCarthy, had done in 1968. That didn't go very well.
No, it didn't go very well. But, look, there's a huge difference. Americans are not fighting and dying in the Middle East right now, whereas the Vietnam War cost 56,000 American lives alongside about 2 million Vietnamese lives, and at a time when there was a draft, as there has not been really pretty much since the end of the Vietnam War.
1968, of course, there's one other big difference. The convention in Chicago at that time was the city whose mayor was Richard J. Daley, a right-wing Democrat who ordered the police to shoot to kill anyone with a Molotov cocktail in his hand and to shoot to maim or cripple anyone looting any stores in our city. Those are quotes. I don't think Chicago's current mayor, the black progressive Brandon Johnson, is going to do that.
No, he wouldn't do that. But there's a there's a very real question as to, regardless of the particular positions of the mayor, whether the Chicago police force has changed all that much. I mean, a lot of what was going on in '68 was really the flashpoint beginning of the culture wars. And the last time I looked, those are still ongoing. And I don't doubt that we're going to see some of that unless Biden changes policy.
Of course, 6 months is a lifetime in American politics, so it would be surprising if things did not change between now and November 5th.
Yes, it would. Again, Donald Trump concentrates the mind in a way that even Richard Nixon did not.
Well, finally, it's time for News of the Class Struggle in America, a regular feature of this broadcast. We want an update on the news about union organizing in the South. This week, I believe there's a vote at the VW plant in Chattanooga on the UAW affiliation.
Yeah, the vote started this Wednesday and will conclude this Friday. And the vote should be counted by Friday night. And, the people who are close to this are fairly confident that this time the UAW will win. It narrowly lost its two earlier campaigns. And that would be a huge breakthrough for American unions. To win something this big in the very non-union South.
As we have noted in past broadcasts here, after VW in Chattanooga, the next UAW vote will be at the Mercedes plant in Vance, Alabama, where we are told a supermajority of the 5,000 workers have signed cards requesting a unionization vote. I think the NLRB has not set a date for that vote. But what effect do you think a VW victory for the UAW in Chattanooga would have on the Mercedes workers in Vance, Alabama?
Well, I mean, a VW victory in Chattanooga, first of all, has been affected by the terrific contracts the UAW won after striking the big three. And by the same token, I think a UAW victory in Vance will be made more probable by a victory in Chattanooga with VW. I mean, there's a sort of momentum to periods of union growth. It's not like this is a steady state thing, but when it inches up. Historically in this country, union growth has been explosive in certain particular periods, the mid-late 1930s and early 1940s being the last example of that. We may be seeing the beginning of that period again.
I read that at the Mercedes in Alabama, there had been a two-tier wage system and very little in the way of pay raises over the last several years. But after the current union drive started, Mercedes voluntarily ended the two-tier system and announced long-awaited raises. The raises still do not equal what UAW workers won in their recent strikes, and that's why one theme of the UAW campaign at Mercedes in Alabama is End the Alabama Discount. Kind of a winning slogan.
It is. The Southern political establishment, which at this point is overwhelmingly Republican, keeps saying, well, we want to preserve everything that makes, you know, the economy great here. We want to preserve the Southern model. And Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, is going around saying, yeah, the Southern model is what keeps your wages low. So the UAW is taking this on as frontally as is humanly possible.
Well, now I'd like to talk about religion in American politics. Donald Trump, speaking to reporters in Atlanta last Wednesday, said that any Jew who votes for Biden, quote, should have their head examined. And on talk radio last month, he said that any Jew who backed Democrats, quote, hates their religion, close quote. What proportion of Jews do back Democrats? I think you can help us answer this question.
Well, last week, the Pew Research Center came out with its, I think, biennial, very deep poll, polling over 10,000 people nationally on political alignments, which found the two parties basically at parity, I think 47 to 46 for the Democrats. But the real value of this poll is they investigate all kinds of subgroups by race, education, marital status, income, you name it. And one of the ways they break down the survey is by religion. And so, you know, some of what it tells us we already know, that white evangelical Christians are 85% aligned with Republicans, and black Protestants, which is the bulk of church-going African Americans, are at, I think, also 85 or one point different aligned with the Democrats. But one thing I noted looking at the poll was that, you know, none of the religions polled had really similar numbers to each other, different for Catholics from Protestants, from Mormons, and so on. And what then leaped out at me was, well, heck, there are two religious groups that really resemble each other in terms of partisan alignment. They found that 69% of Jews align themselves with the Democratic Party, either members or leaners, and 66% of Muslims did the same. So here we are in the midst of a horrific Israeli, Jewish, Palestinian rift, and both sides have almost an identical alignment towards the Democrats.
But it is surprising that Jews and Muslims would have virtually the same level of support for the Democrats. How do you explain this?
Well, I think the fundamental reason is that, you know, as I noted in our earlier discussion, it still is the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party, that is home to the growing opposition to the Biden policy. But more fundamentally, these are both very distinct minority populations that have often been discriminated against and often threatened and often the victims of some horrific crime. So they are both self-aware minority groups, and they have therefore often joined larger coalitions, and sometimes they join the same coalition that defends minority rights and civil liberties. This is kind of the position of beleaguered minorities that are enlightened enough to know that they need to join larger forces to protect their rights and well-being.
Donald Trump also said that Election Day, November 5th, would be, quote, Christian Visibility Day. I wonder if you think he's right about that.
This is like the old Fox thing about the war on Christmas, which I never remembered really having major casualties. And the notion that Christians, A, need to be visible, and B, that they are otherwise invisible, and C, that a voting pattern makes them more distinctly Christian, other than numerically in the polls, a kind of interesting notion. But it's in keeping with the we are all victims psychology that is one of the roots of the MAGA movement and Trump and all the far right that's rising across the planet.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold.
Always good to be here, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. It's been a bad week for Donald Trump. For our report, we turn to John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of many books. Most recently, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, co-authored by Bernie Sanders. John, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, John.
Well, this is the week the criminal case of the people of New York versus Donald J. Trump begins in Manhattan. For the first time in American history, a former president is facing criminal prosecution. The testimony will remind people how, at the peak of the 2016 campaign, shortly after that Access Hollywood tape became public, that's where Trump, of course, boasted of grabbing women sexually, he paid for the silence of people. Allegedly, people who possessed damaging stories about his behavior with women, and he then falsified business records of the Trump Organization to hide those payments. We know about this from testimony of his fixer at the time, Michael Cohen, who paid adult film actress Stormy Daniels $130,000 to keep quiet about her alleged sex with Trump. This was shortly after Melania gave birth to Barron. The payment was made through a shell company. He also set up a $150,000 payment for the publisher of the National Enquirer to Playboy model Karen McDougal for her story about an affair with Trump. That money would give the National Enquirer exclusive rights to Karen McDougal's story about sex with Trump, meaning they could decline to publish it and she could not take it elsewhere. This practice is known as catch and kill. Trump then allegedly falsified business records to reimburse Cohen for legal expenses. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has charged Trump with 34 counts, felonies, of falsifying those records. The case might last as long as 8 weeks. Trump, of course, again, is playing the victim, raising money off of his supporters around the trial, swearing to use the power of the presidency if he is reelected to get the people who have done this to him. A lot of pundits say these charges are insignificant compared to the January 6th charges. And some suggest that 8 weeks of testimony about Trump paying off a porn star might evoke admiration and envy among some of his male supporters, but it's not going to help him with suburban white women who vote. I think it's much more likely to hurt him than to help him. What do you think?
I will tell you that the whatever admiration and envy that is evoked from being on trial for 8 weeks is probably going to be among folks who are already going to vote for Trump anyway. So I don't think there's much chance that this trial helps him. I think there's a lot of chance that it hurts him. In fact, I think it's already hurting him, not least because he appears to have fallen asleep at one point during the trial, which is a little weird and might even provoke some speculation about his aging or his abilities. But at the heart of it is a real political calculus. And that's this. In the primaries where they did exit polls, and that would be New Hampshire, to some extent Iowa, but the caucuses, but also South Carolina. In those early stages, they asked a question, and it was, if Donald Trump is convicted of any of the charges that he faces, would that impact your thinking about voting for him? And an incredibly large portion of Republicans, not just people who voted for Nikki Haley or others in those caucuses and primaries, but even some people who were voting for Trump, said, yes, it would be a big deal. In fact, some states you were getting toward, a majority or nearly half of the voters. And what you have to recognize is that whether Trump is convicted on these charges or not, that's a substantial portion of the Republican base that is looking at this as something that's problematic. 8 weeks of trial and testimony with people who are, in many cases, longtime associates of Trump, turning on him and saying he did illegal and illicit things. He was a bad player. He was an untrustworthy player, et cetera, et cetera. I think coming in the context of the run-up to a presidential convention, it's a pretty bad thing. And so I do think this is overall, I don't see any way that it doesn't damage him. And obviously, if he's convicted, then I think it does quite a bit of damage.
Yeah, to avoid conviction, he just has to have that one juror. And of course, both sides are very much aware that one juror can hang the jury. And so the Trump defense team is doing everything they can to get one juror who will stand alone against the obvious implications of all the evidence. And the prosecution is going to do everything it can to keep the jury, people who will pay attention to the evidence and rule accordingly. That's what's going to be happening this week.
Yeah, and that's the basics of the law, right? Donald Trump's lawyers have a responsibility to try and find a jury that will give him his best shot at getting off the hook. Most people who go on a jury ultimately take seriously their oath when they say that they're going to listen to the facts and try and judge fairly according to the law. A good judge kind of reinforces that through the process. And so for all this speculation now about who's going to be on the jury one way or the other, I think at the heart of the matter, you've got the case as regards Trump. If Bragg and his associates make this case effectively, they can get their conviction. I'm not saying they will. I mean, there's still all the realities of a trial to be seen. But my sense is that a lot of the people who were dismissive of this case, a lot of the pundits who were dismissive of this case, what they didn't recognize was a particular reality, which is this case came very early, right? This was, way before some of the other charges against Trump. That's given Bragg and his associates a lot of time to put together what ought to be an effective prosecution. They know they're in the limelight. They know what they're up against. They also know how Trump behaves in the courtroom, how he attacks those who are trying to prosecute him. So my sense is that they're going to be prepared. And if they are prepared, if you look at the facts that we have, at least up to this point, it doesn't look good for Donald Trump. It doesn't look good for him at all.
One other thing. Trump says he wants to testify. If you were on Trump's defense team, what advice would you give him?
If I was being paid by Donald Trump to try and get him off the hook, I would desperately plead for him not to testify. And I would also hope that he might fall asleep during that portion of the trial and not demand to be up there. But at a certain point, when you have a powerful client who's paying you a lot of money, you defer to that client, even if it doesn't make sense. And Trump always has this bravado about him where he says, oh, I want to testify, I want to take him on and stuff like that. We'll see as the trial progresses if he really wants to take that stand. Because frankly, if he does, I would say the chances of conviction skyrocket.
The rest of Trump's week wasn't so good either. The New York Times poll showed he's lost ground in the last month and that the popular vote right now is basically tied. Of 22 national polls released since March 25th, Biden leads in 9, Trump in 8. The candidates are tied in 5. Mm-hmm. There are new polls with Biden ahead in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where the Wall Street Journal poll on April 2nd had Biden at 41, Trump 38, Robert Kennedy Jr. 10, Cornell West at 1%. Do you have any wisdom to offer on the state of the polls this week?
Sure. Joe Biden hit rock bottom in his polling last November. That provoked a huge discussion among Democrats about, you know, whether he was the guy or whether, you know, there's even talk that maybe he should stand down. There was also at the same time a parallel pressure by the Republicans to suggest that he was incompetent, that he was simply dysfunctional. The Republicans did him a huge favor because you got to the State of the Union address. Joe Biden got up there, gave a very effective State of the Union address, very quick-witted, on top of things, handling, you know, all the challenges that came his way, including Marjorie Taylor Greene shouting at him and stuff like that. And suddenly a lot of the weakness and the damage that had been done to Biden dissipated. And I think that's what we've been seeing since then, which is a steady ticking up in the polls, both nationally and in the battleground states. And now I think, yeah, you're at a point where you can say that Biden is either tied or potentially even, you know, moving into a lead. Tip for you, pro tip, if you're looking to cover politics, being a candidate who is surging into the lead as the campaign takes shape is a good thing. It's even better if your opponent is on trial for, you know, all sorts of scandalous things. And so for Biden, this looks pretty good. The one counsel I'd give, though, and this is an important one to keep track of, is that Robert F. Kennedy number. That's a lot of votes, 10% in Wisconsin, the state that where I live. Roughly parallel numbers in a number of other states. Why this matters is because Kennedy draws from both Biden and from Trump. And I think that he's going to be a continuing complicating factor. And I think too much of the punditry, too much of the coverage of this race doesn't pay a lot of attention to the Kennedy campaign. I think you have to pay attention to it. And you have to realize that, you know, much as Ross Perot in 1992 became a decisive figure in that race, even though he didn't win, you got to keep track of that. With that said, with that proviso, my sense is that Biden's in pretty good shape.
One other thing about Trump's bad week that matters a lot to Donald Trump: stock in Trump Media is down 60%. As a metaphor, it's certainly powerful. Is it anything more than a metaphor?
It's really powerful because he's relying on that to, you know, he's trying to pile up money to deal with some real serious challenges. One being all of his legal troubles, not just the one we're talking about, but all of his cases, paying a lot of lawyers a lot of money. Also, frankly, losing cases and having to pay huge fines, you know, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And so as a result, you know, his economic status is an issue, just a practical issue there. But beyond that, separate from that, is the image of Donald Trump as, you know, what people historically saw him as: a deal maker, an effective guy, a guy who, you know, knew how to make money. You know, I no longer refer to Trump as a billionaire. I refer to him as an alleged billionaire because there's an awful lot of evidence that there was a lot of smoke and mirrors there. And I think this feeds into that. So yeah, it's damaging to him on a number of levels. It's also, frankly, revealing in a terrible way for his enthusiasts. Can you imagine the poor people that went out and bought stock in his media operation? You know, like working class people, middle class people who thought, wow, that's a great investment. That's shooting up. Trump hasn't lost a lot of money here. They've lost a lot of money. His supporters, once again, he has taken advantage of them, and they've come out behind.
John Nichols. John, thanks for that report, and thanks for talking with us today.
It's an honor to be with you, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Now we want to talk about prestige TV, historical dramas streaming now, The Sympathizer, Manhunt, A Gentleman in Moscow, and Shogun. For that, we turn to John Powers. He's critic at large on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, where he's heard by more than 8 million listeners on the radio and the podcast. He's worked for 25 years as a critic and columnist, first at the LA Weekly, then Vogue. His work has also appeared in The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Nation. Last time he was here, we talked about the film American Fiction, based on Percival Everett's wonderful novel, Erasure. John Powers, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Well, I want to start with The Sympathizer, 7 episodes on HBO. I think it's the best of what we're reviewing today. Episode 1, at least, I thought was spectacularly good. That's the only one that's available to us civilians right now. You, of course, have seen more. The series is based on a terrific novel by Viet Nguyen that came out in 2015 and won the Pulitzer Prize that year. The TV series is an espionage thriller that HBO says is a cross-cultural satire about the struggles of a half-French, half-Vietnamese communist spy during the last days of the Vietnam War, and then his new life as a refugee in LA, where he's been sent to spy on the anti-communist exile leaders. So it's a spy series. It's very much about the psychology of the spy. But it's not like a John le Carré spy series.
No, it's not. I mean, what it is is that it's a portrait, I think, of many different kinds of ambivalence. It is a story about a guy who he's loyal to Vietnam, which is why he's a North Vietnamese spy. But he has two great friends. He's blood brothers with these friends. They call themselves the Three Musketeers. He is in the center. On one side is one who's a North Vietnamese spy secretly. On the other side, a gung-ho South Vietnamese soldier who's exceedingly violent and very loyal. He's caught between those two, and his job essentially is he's been brought in by the North Vietnamese to spy on a general of the Saigon regime, first in Saigon and then later as they move to Los Angeles and begin their new lives. The general, you know, owns a liquor store. And our hero is more or less trying to keep tabs on them for the North Vietnamese while feeling more and more isolated the entire time.
The first thing we see at the beginning of episode 1 is a title card that says, in America, they call it the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, they call it the American War. That tells us a lot about what's to come.
It does, yes. I mean, because one of the most basic things is that, I mean, I've seen lots of Vietnam shows. And I think at the time I first read The Sympathizer, I thought it was probably the best thing I'd read by someone showing me how it would look from the other side of, I guess, of the looking glass. And this show does that.
The first episode is about our protagonist's confession, which he's ordered to write in longhand in a communist re-education camp just after the fall of Saigon. We think he has nothing to confess. He worked as a spy for the Viet Cong inside the Saigon government secret police. And yet what?
Well, and yet there's always something to confess. And, you know, among the things about this character, there are things he likes about the United States. You know, he likes the pop songs, even though he's not quite sure he should. You know, that's something you have to confess.
One key scene of episode 1 really struck me. Our hero has set up one of his fellow North Vietnamese agents in Saigon to be caught with secret Saigon government documents that he has given her. She is very roughly interrogated, and the interrogators try to get her to reveal who gave her the documents, who, of course, was our hero. Well, the captain, he's called. He's a captain in the Saigon government. The captain watches her interrogation where they're forcing her to reveal that she got these documents from him. But she refuses. She doesn't name him because she is totally committed to the cause of revolution. And there's a close-up of his face in tears. And he has to be thinking, is his own commitment as total as hers? After all, he did tell us at the very beginning that he's a man of two faces and also of two minds.
Yes, that is the great drama. Is the drama of both of his friends are deeply committed. His friend, the one who fights for the South Vietnamese, is gung-ho. He will die for it. The North Vietnamese guy will die for it. Whereas he's in between, he doesn't know whether he will, but he's doing the things you do. As it is, he set up this woman who you just described, basically to be tortured, to reveal something, and he knows it, basically he's responsible for it. And yet he's not sure he's completely sold on it, you know, which at some level is maybe even more something to confess, which is you get somebody tortured and you're not really sure you believe in it. Whereas like a hardened revolutionary, often the thought would be you would just do it because you know it's the necessary thing. And on his face, you know he's not sure it's necessary.
You mentioned the man who should be his nemesis, the general who he's been appointed to spy on, who heads the Saigon government secret police. But the general is not just the villain. He's actually an interesting guy, sort of likable in some ways. So this is complicated too.
It is complicated, you know, because it's one of the classic things of spy novels and many of the greatest kind of double agent things is that you actually like and become friends with the people you're betraying. And in a way, that's harder than almost anything because you spend so much time with them. And the more time with them, the more you see the things from their point of view. And you feel a certain affection, especially because the guy playing the general he's childish, he's paranoid, but he's kind of charming and likable. The actor's a wonderful actor. And so you even though you know he's kind of monstrous, you also kind of like him. And that's exactly what the captain feels. You know, but he's having to do things both for him that he thinks are abhorrent and against him that are probably abhorrent, you know, which is a strange place to be working both sides and doing bad things for both sides, which is the classic thing, I think, of the double agent story, is that you wind up hurting everybody in every direction and feeling terrible about yourself.
One of my favorite things about the first episode is the portrayal of the streets of Saigon in 1975. It just looks spectacular. The credits say these were shot in Thailand.
The first three episodes are incredibly well directed by the South Korean director Park Chan-wook, who has made lots of great movies. I mean, most famous for Old Boy for Cannes, but you know, he directed Little Drummer Girl recently on TV. He's one of the world's great directors. And his way of capturing the way the city looks or the escape from Saigon, his way of capturing the emotion, it is so perfectly done. I mean, it is a level of directing. You've mentioned other shows, just like a huge leap beyond the other three things, which are often like good looking or pretty or skillful. This is like really great, and it's dealing with such complexity, and it is capturing, especially for those of us of a certain age, the look that you remember seeing in newsreels and stuff when you're watching. It was on TV every night. Well, they weren't really newsreels, but it was the newscasts. And when they get to Los Angeles, it's the same way. You think, oh, I recognize the world looking this way in the mid-70s.
Robert Downey plays all four of the white characters. The idea here is to reverse the stereotypical treatment of Asian characters in film and TV. All white men are roughly interchangeable with slight variations. Do you think that works here with Robert Downey?
I was a little annoyed by it finally because he's a little broad. The idea is that all of the people he deals with, whether it's a college professor or a congressman, they're all the same entitled, blind, slightly cartoonish white guy. And conceptually that works. I think that in the actual show, he's a little big. And he seems even bigger because he's by far the most famous person in the show. So your eyes almost are automatically drawn to the movie star always. And I began thinking, would it be better if you just had four white guys who weren't played the same character, but all of whom were the same kind of guy?
That's The Sympathizer, 7 episodes on HBO and Max.
And a really good show, a really good show.
Prestige TV at its best. Let's also talk about Manhunt, 7 episodes on Apple TV. This is a sort of a police procedural about capturing the man who assassinated Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth. We know what's going to happen, but somehow the show is nevertheless pretty intense and scary because we learn right away at the outset that John Wilkes Booth did not act alone. There were simultaneous efforts to assassinate the vice president and the secretary of state, both of which failed. I never learned about this in American history. I imagine most viewers didn't. So our hero, the Secretary of State Edward Stanton, played by Tobias Menzies, needs to find out how big was this conspiracy and who is behind it. Was it just Booth and his sidekicks, or was it the Confederate government? Lee had surrendered just 5 days before. And if they killed the president, the war will have to be renewed. For me, somehow the echoes to the present were the scary part, even though that couldn't have been part of the conception of, I mean, this is based on a book written 10 years ago before anyone ever imagined Trump. But, you know, what will Trump supporters do if and when he loses in November? Last time it was, you know, hang Mike Pence and get Nancy Pelosi. So I found Manhunt to be gripping and kind of scary.
It is. And it is funny. I think it's a good reminder that American history is much crazier than we have been taught. I mean, I think I probably had vaguely heard at some point there might have been a conspiracy with Booth, but it was never in my head. I certainly, when I was going to school, that wasn't the way that it was ever taught. The idea that, you know, that up in Montreal, there, you know, there's a Confederacy-owned bank that actually has deposited money in John Wilkes Booth's account, so that in fact it is part of a big conspiracy. It is a scary thing about now because you do feel it. Like the lowercase version is when Trump was defeated in the last election, I think everyone thought, oh, finally it's over, rather than thinking, oh no, it's going to continue for years with the claim that in fact he actually won the election and was robbed, and that now that's an article of faith for an entire party, an entire huge media networks. Even though they denied it at the time, they now don't want to deny it anymore because it cost them their advertising money. So I do feel this, and it is very well done. The director of this is Carl Franklin, who's an excellent director. The guy who plays John Wilkes Booth is very, very good. I mean, a Northern Irish guy. You know, it seems like we can't even, you know, we're even having to outsource our assassins, John. Can you believe that? We can't even find an American who can play John Wilkes Booth. Yet, don't you feel like somehow out in America, we have another John Wilkes Booth who is being played by an American?
Manhunt, 7 episodes on Apple TV. And then we want to talk about A Gentleman from Moscow. This provides a critique of the Russian Revolution from the viewpoint of the aristocracy. The Bolsheviks, we learn, were mean to the noblemen and knew nothing about wine. In this show, our hero, Count Alexander Rostov, played by Ewan McGregor, is sentenced to a kind of house arrest in a Grand Moscow hotel where he sleeps in a former maid's room, but otherwise lives a life of 5-star luxury for 30 years. According to the publicity, the theme is that as the Soviet regime descends into tyranny, the Count discovers the value of love, courage, and community. Somehow it never raises the question, could it be that the Count and his family mercilessly exploited the serfs on their estates? That's not what this is about. The Count is a charming and delightful character, and so is the beautiful movie star he sleeps with, so is the little girl he befriends, so is the warm-hearted hotel worker who cares for bees up on the roof. It's a simple idea. Stalinism was bad. The Russian aristocracy was charming and delightful. Is this story worth 8 hours?
Well, it's not worth 8 hours. It is a charming enough story, I guess. You know, and the Count is a charming guy, and Ewan McGregor plays him very winningly. A probably younger, angrier version of myself you know, would have culminated about this. You know, given that you don't even have the decency to explain why there had been a Russian Revolution, and that someone like Ewan McGregor, who could be charming, is because he never had to do a lick of work in his entire life, and was drinking Chateauneuf du Pape off the blood of his serfs.
Thank you for that.
There are two or three things interesting about it to me. One of them is the way that it's an incredibly reactionary idea. That you then is also slightly woke in that his best friend Mishka is played by a black man, and that working in the kitchen with names like Alyosha are people of Arabic and Indian descent and who obviously aren't Russian. So therefore you're doing colorblind casting.
Yes.
Okay. Which as I said, I mean, and that's the kind of gesture toward modernity and progressiveness. And at the same time, the whole story does seem to be about the leveling awful nature of communism. But the one thing I would say that was interesting was, I think it's possible that even a hardened man like you, John Wiener, might have identified a little bit with the count in the following sense, that I feel that I can imagine a great many liberal-minded and maybe even left-wing watchers would think this is also a Trump story, that it's not, that there's no real politics, but it's about you being, knowing things, being educated, knowing how the world works, and being thrown out or being abused by people who don't really know anything, who don't read books, who don't understand the world in a complex way. They're just angry. I can imagine that many people who watch that will think, oh, this isn't actually about the Russian Revolution. This is about what's going to happen here in 9 months.
A Gentleman from Moscow is on Paramount Plus and on Showtime, 8 episodes. Finally, on our list of prestige TV on historical topics is the most immense and gorgeous of all, Shogun, set in 17th century Japan. 10 episodes on Hulu and FX, based on a 1975 best-selling novel by James Clavell, previously a miniseries in 1980. It's about the political rivalry and intrigue among feudal lords, and it is about a real history that Lord Torinaga was the founder and first shogun of the Tokugawa period, which lasted from 1603 to 1867. The problem for us today about the TV show is that the 1975 novel had to fulfill the conventions of its day. It had to have a white man at the center, and the 2025 miniseries can't avoid some, at least, of the same plot. John Blackthorne is a risk-taking English sailor, played by somebody I didn't know, Cosmo Jarvis, who ends up shipwrecked and taken prisoner in Japan. We follow as he learns about his captors. And of course, there has to be what used to be called a love interest. We have a beautiful, exotic Japanese woman with a mysterious past. So the structure of the whole series rests on these two, I think we have to say, Eurocentric elements. And of course, it is true that people who made this film know about this. 44 years after the first miniseries, the Japanese characters get a lot more screen time. But really, isn't it still the heroic white man who saves the day? No. And the mysterious Oriental beauty who still finds him irresistible? Or am I wrong about this?
I think you're wrong about this. You do have John Blackthorne, played by Cosmo Jarvis, who didn't mean anything to me either. But he's almost like a placeholder in the series. It's very strange that you keep thinking, oh, at some point he's going to be doing the important stuff in the series. And you realize, oh, he's not. He's there because you actually need a surrogate person, a surrogate Westerner, because that's part of the story, and that's what everybody knows about Shogun. But if you took him out, probably 90% of the series would be exactly the same. Maybe in the final episodes, which I haven't seen, he will come through and save the day and do something important. But if you compare it to the 70s version, where John Blackthorne is the center of the action, here he's not the center of the action. And you realize, oh, that he's this person who's kind of just constantly complaining. He's constantly complaining about like not getting enough to do. You know, can't you just put me back on my boat? And the answer is no, because we've moved on. And so now we realize that the story of the rise of the Tokugawa shogunate is a Japanese story, in the same way that the Vietnam War is a Vietnamese story.
Very good.
But in narrative terms, it does skew things weirdly, because you still have to have the romance plot a bit. And you still have to have the white guy there. But you do, as you're watching it, think you don't have to have the white guy there. Why is he there? And the other thing in 40 years is the Japanese people now don't speak halting English. They actually get to speak fluent Japanese. And yet, on the other hand, we don't care. The sympathizer, which is the obvious comparison point, is about West and East also, but it still has a sting and a reality to us. Whereas the battle between the English and the Portuguese over Japanese rights or Catholicism and Protestantism, that doesn't really sting very much. And there's nothing going on in the surface about what it's actually about. No, you know, whereas the sympathizer really is raises all sorts of questions along the way. And you think, oh, this is really alive to the present moment. And Shogun is a very enjoyable enough show to watch with great production values and attractive people and all the rest. But there's nothing at stake for us when we're watching it except narratively.
Also, I just want to say the costumes, the setting, the scenery are lavish and magnificent.
They are all of those things. And yet what's interesting is that it's not calendar art, but it's more beautiful in that kind of way, whereas the beauty of something like The Sympathizer is a more kinetic and urgent beauty that feels modern. The other is more pictorially beautiful rather than cinematically beautiful.
Excellent. Shogun, 10 episodes on Hulu and FX. So in conclusion, from our review of The Sympathizer, Manhunt, Gentleman in Moscow, and Shogun, I conclude that prestige TV is not just alive and well, but thriving this season.
I think all four of these shows are worth some sort of attention. The Sympathizer, clearly to my mind, being the best of them. You know, but Shogun, this version of Shogun, clearly being an advance beyond the one that was a huge hit in the non-prestige TV days. Gentleman in Moscow is a very, you know, it's a very enjoyable show. And Manhunt's a well-made show. It has good actors. It is spooky. It teaches you something you didn't know about American. And as you say, has an interesting contemporary resonance that I'll bet you even the people who made it did feel by the time they were making it. I'm sure they felt that there's a contemporary resonance. Fascinating.
John Powers, he's critic at large on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. John, thank you for talking with us today.
It is always my pleasure, John.
That's it for today's Living in the USA. Our social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at livinginthusapod.com. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.